It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Demographers for the last couple of decades say that white flight is over, that people move to different cities and towns and neighborhoods for economic reasons, not racial ones. Samuel Kai says that is not true. He researches race and community at Indiana University in Bloomington, where he is getting his PhD. His latest research focuses on ethnic trends in urban neighborhoods. He studied the census data, and he says they're the biggest motivator for why people move is the number of people of color who live among them. Sam Kai, welcome to the program.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
We also want to take your calls on this, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, as usual, at ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So let's pull back here, Sam, and let's look at this term to begin with. What is white flight?
Sure. So white flight is the movement of white households away from diverse and integrated neighborhoods to preserve what has been longstanding residential segregation since the post-World War II era. Now, as you mentioned, there are have been debates about what predicts white flight, whether or not this is for economic or racial reasons. But generally, as we understand it, white flight is the mobility of white households away from integrated neighborhoods.
And there's a tipping point, you say. You know, some people say that white flight is because they just want to go to a better neighborhood. But what do you think is prompting it?
Well, so what my research addresses is, as you mentioned, this debate about really what is the reason for white flight. So, you know, there has been a school of thought that has suggested that rather than being motivated by, you know, prejudice or discrimination, what white flight actually reflects is the desire among all households, including Black residents, to live in locations where there's less poverty, low crime, good schools. And, you know, one thing that is so insidious about segregation is that, as I heard in your past hour, that it concentrates poverty in certain neighborhoods. Mm. And because for so long there has been this overlap of Black neighborhoods coinciding with poverty, you know, we've really been unable to untangle whether or not white flight is racially motivated or economically motivated. So where my research comes in is that over the past several decades, we've seen a tremendous demographic shift of minority groups to the suburbs. Actually, since 1990, each of the major racial ethnic groups now resides, for the most part, the majority of Asians, Hispanics, and Blacks actually now resides in suburban neighborhoods. So what this allowed me to do was say, okay, we see within suburbia two trends. On one hand, we see non-whites who are actually achieving the quote-unquote American dream. They're residing in neighborhoods that, by any standard of measure, are middle class, whether it be median household income, median property values. But on the other hand, we do see this continued sorting of minority households into poorer suburban locations, such as inner ring suburbs. And so this sets up a natural experiment where you can say, okay, if we have groups in each of these types of neighborhoods, if white flight really is economically motivated, what we should see then is that white flight is relatively low in middle-class neighborhoods and higher in these poorer areas. But what my research actually found was that, in fact, when you examine suburban neighborhoods in the 150 largest metropolitan areas, white flight is actually more likely in middle-class neighborhoods than their poor counterparts.
You know, I talk to people who say that they're moving out of a neighborhood, they're moving out of an area because they don't want their housing values to fall. And I kind of think of that as maybe there are too many Black people moving into an area, and when Black people move in, the housing values fall. Speak to that.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a common refrain that you hear. And actually, you know, what most people are surprised to learn is that in contrast to that stereotype, when Black families actually move into predominantly white neighborhoods, property values are actually more likely to go up because African Americans often have to pay a premium to access these neighborhoods. Mm. So, right, what this indicates is that there is a chasm between what is reality and what is stereotype. And, you know, one thing that my research tries to address is, why are we seeing the persistence of white flight? You know, consider, for example, that, you know, large social surveys like the Gallup poll, you know, what they showed in 1960 was that more than 50% of whites indicated that they would move if black households moved in. But by 2000, that figure was less than 1%. So, you know, we're seeing this sea change in attitudes, but what this indicates is that the reasons for why whites are moving on the surface appear, as you mentioned, to be economically motivated. But the reality is that many people continue to use the racial composition of a neighborhood as an indicator of what they perceive, how neighborhoods may change. And so as a result, we're seeing this continued process where, even despite the fact that, you know, we've largely seen a decline in pure racial animus, you know, we continue to see the persistence of racial segregation.
So there's a disconnect from what people say about race and what they actually do and where they actually choose to live.
You know, that's a complex issue because, you know, one thing that I've received a lot of, you know, feedback about, you know, I've had people email me, even call me at times and say, you know, why shouldn't I take these things into consideration? You know, and I would certainly not, you know, tell any household that they shouldn't move somewhere where there isn't low crime and good schools. But, you know, the disconnect where that comes is that, you know, because of residential segregation created, again, as I mentioned, such a stark concentration of race and poverty through the 60s and the 70s, you know, that lingering stereotype still persists. And so, you know, the difference between economic reasons and racial reasons is largely semantic, because in the end, regardless of what reasons people cite, the reality is that these mobility behaviors are continuing to reproduce segregation.
Okay, I want you to speak to that a little bit here, because I think that there are a lot of white people who equate, whether they mean to or not, they equate poverty with color, and then sort of like make that, a flaw of some sort of the person. But it's really the issue is really that people were concentrated in particular areas, were not allowed to move into other areas, and that helped create the poverty, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So, you know, when a lot of people think about segregation, many people think of it as de facto segregation. And what I mean by that is that many people think of segregation as something that just kind of happened, you know, when the reality is that it was de jure segregation by our government and through intentional acts of discrimination that created this the separation that we see today. You know, as many of your listeners may be familiar with, there was a process of redlining where in the 1960s and 70s, when our government was pushing for home ownership in this country, many diverse and integrated neighborhoods were redlined and deemed as risky and hazardous locations for federally insured loans. Whereas in contrast, these mass subdivisions of suburban housing that were being created in the suburbs, they were insured. Those mortgages were insured, but with the explicit requirement that they remain all white in composition. So what happened was that you created mass incentive for white households to avoid black neighborhoods and move into white suburban housing. But those same incentives and amenities weren't provided for black residents, creating, you know, yep.
Yeah, no, and you talked about restrictive covenants in these newer white neighborhoods, but in you also talked about the premium that black people need to pay, and often black people could not get the same kinds of mortgages in the neighborhoods that they were restricted to, and what is the long-term fallout of that?
Well, certainly the first thing that comes to mind is that it prevented the generation of wealth. Mm. Home ownership is the primary vehicle to this day by which families accrue wealth in this country. And that is really important, you know, because when things like the Great Recession happened, you know, one thing we know about the Great Recession is that it had a devastating effect on residential segregation and black home ownership, because black households didn't have this safety net to fall back upon. And so as a result, you know, when people are in dire straits, they tend to move back to family and peers. And, you know, especially generations of African Americans, you know, grandparents, you know, they're living in these urban segregated neighborhoods. So, you know, again, the prevention of wealth creation is something that goes back to the same acts of discrimination during the post-World War II era.
And this is discrimination that was done by the state, not any particular state, but by the government itself.
Yes, yes. You know, Richard Rothstein has a great book that makes this fact particularly clear that, you know, these were explicit requirements enforced by our government to create, again, these racially segregated neighborhoods where, you know, again, black neighborhoods were deemed hazardous and risky. All white neighborhoods were universally greenlit as the most stable types of communities. And so, yeah, it was explicit and an action mandated by our government.
We are talking about white flight and segregation in the U.S. now, not in the 1960s or 70s. In a moment, we'll look at how people wind up where they are. It's The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking with Sam Kai, an Indiana University PhD student who wrote about white flight and concluded that it is still happening in 2018. We would love to hear from you on this. 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. What do you think of white flight? Do you live in a suburban area? Is it integrated? Do you want it to be integrated? Do you think that this is just an economic issue? 1-800-642-1234. Sam Kai, your focus in your studies is on something called ethnoburbs. What are ethnoburbs?
Yeah, so ethnoburbs are communities that have fundamentally flipped this historic overlap of race and poverty, right? So generally, when academics have examined ethnic neighborhoods, there tend to be high levels of poverty and instability. But what ethnoburbs is a recent phenomenon where we're seeing ethnic neighborhoods and suburbs that are distinctly middle class. And so they are remarkable places where you often see when it pertains to immigrants, for example, second generation, third generation immigrants who, rather than choosing to move to predominantly white neighborhoods, have in fact continued to cluster in neighborhoods where they have the same types of amenities often found in urban neighborhoods. So, for example, you can think of like a suburban Chinatown. That would be kind of an example of an ethnoburb.
Do you have a list of ethnoburbs around the country? Are there cities that have more of them than other cities?
So I don't have a list in front of me, but you know where you generally tend to find ethnoburbs are places that have traditionally had a dense concentration of urban ethnic communities. You can think of them as satellite type communities. So some places that certainly come to mind are Los Angeles, which has a large concentration of Chinese ethnoburbs. But also, you know, you can kind of think of, you know, it's not quite the same as a Chinatown, for example, but a place like Prince George's County in Washington, D.C. is a example of a starkly middle class black community. So these are happening in places all across the country, and notably for black, Hispanic, and Asian groups.
So it sounds to me, though, that it's still a segregated thing. They're groups living together, but they're not necessarily integrated with each other.
Yeah, so certainly they're an overrepresentation. And I think it's important to be clear that, you know, these aren't places that are 100% Asian or 100% Hispanic. You know, they still have a presence of white and other non-in-group residents. But I think, you know, what I hear in your question is that, you know, is this an example of ethnocentrism where, you know, segregation might persist? because groups just want to live with one another. Mm. And certainly that is a popular idea in the discourse. But, you know, actually, one of the reasons why I was led to this current project was because I actually found that, you know, segregation levels were higher in these ethno-Berb communities. But when you dig into the data, what you actually find is that, you know, there are a number of ways a community can become segregated, right? One is certainly that you have this continuous influx of, say, for example, Asian residents, and whites eventually become a minority and small population. But, you know, what the research actually shows is that when these Asian residents are moving in, it's still relatively a diverse and integrated neighborhood. But you are seeing simultaneous processes of white flight away from these communities that in turn produces what we eventually find as a predominantly Asian neighborhood. So these are two simultaneous streams of migration that are happening.
We are talking about white flight in the 21st century. It is still happening. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Terrence from Madison, welcome to the program.
Hi. I would just like to say, you know, not as a counterpoint, but almost as a support of this, I actually moved into a fairly integrated neighborhood in the Madison area. And, you know, I had a lot of motivations for moving there. Some of it was economic, you know, being close to jobs and all that. But one component of it was the ethnic makeup. I grew up in an area that was not just predominantly white, but overwhelmingly white. and it really, it affected my worldview. And I had a hard time when I went up to college and moved out to California, and then moved back, had a hard time adjusting to all that. And I didn't want my kids to have that same experience. I didn't want them, you know, if you're not if you're not used to something, you're a little uncomfortable with it. And that was a really kind of awful feeling. And I did not want my kids to have that sort of, you know, handicap, I guess, going into the world. And so they have, you know, a very diverse set of friends, and they get along with them just fine, and I love the neighborhood I'm in. And
so, if you don't mind me asking, where are you? Are you west or east? That's pretty much the question here in Madison.
I'm on the east side, and it's not, I guess, what you would consider one of the traditional black or Hispanic neighborhoods in Madison, but it is one of the more integrated areas of Madison.
Thank you, Terrence. I appreciate that. You know, Sam, I did the same thing when I had kids. I specifically moved into a suburb south of Chicago that was integrated for that very reason. Do you find that there are more white people who are like, come on, we live in a world full of different people, and our kids should be exposed to that?
You know, what I would say is that, you know, those two examples, and Terrence, thank you for your call. You know, that is certainly an example of, I guess, what's on the line here, right? Why does segregation matter? Well, it matters because there has been a growing body of research that shows that when groups come into contact with one another, it does a tremendous amount to reduce stereotypes, to create better ethnic relations, and to create the kinds of, you know, less divisive political community alliances that are becoming of increasing importance to our country today. But to answer your question, you know, what the research actually shows, and, you know, hopefully we begin to find evidence against this, is that, you know, when you actually examine the mobility of whites in the aggregate in this country, you know, what you find is that it's actually stratified by age groups. And what it shows is that whereas younger white households, so the older millennials, those ages 40 and younger, they are actually moving towards more diverse locations. But in contrast, it's those whites 40 years and up, so baby boomers, late baby boomers, who are moving towards more segregated areas. And this creates, you know, an interesting puzzle for us moving forward. On one hand, you know, this could be an example of, you know, as Terrence mentioned, perhaps evidence of a sea change in attitudes, right? That, you know, we have cohorts of households who have grown up in more diverse environments. And as a result, their moves are reflecting the types of environments that they grew up in, where there's less of a resistance to diverse communities. On the other hand, it could be an example of once these same younger households move into the age categories where they have to think about things like good schools, good neighborhoods, that, you know, they again transition into moving into less diverse locations. So it'll be really interesting to see how this all pans out moving forward.
And this unconscious racial bias that they would be kind of giving into, yes?
Yeah, you know, again, this idea that racial composition of a neighborhood is often used as an indication of a neighborhood's quality. You know, there was a great study done in 2001 that, you know, across neighborhoods in the U.S. actually combined crime data with indications of whites' perceptions of a neighborhood's crime. And what they found was that the number of black residents in a neighborhood was often a stronger predictor of whites' perceptions of crime in that community than the actual crime rate itself. And so what this shows is, again, right, that racial composition is often used as the sole indicator of a neighborhood's quality and desirability.
Joe from Milwaukee, welcome to the program, Joe.
How are you doing?
Good. What's your question or comment?
I've got two comments. One is that when you talk about white flight and whites are demonized for leaving the neighborhood when blacks move in, but yet when whites move into a black neighborhood, it's called gentrification. They're demonized for moving into a black neighborhood. The other point I want to make is that it's simply a fact that the thing that correlates strongest with the crime rate of an area is the number of blacks in that area. It's more so than poverty. Right. So it's if you want to look at the data, it's simply the fact that the trait, whatever sociological trait you want to look at, the strongest one is the percentage of blacks in the neighborhood. And what you want to talk about, that is, it's right there.
OK, actually, Sam, you want to answer that?
Yeah, sure. So thanks for the question, Joe. And, you know, again, I think what I want to step away from is I'm certainly not here to demonize, you know, white callers or white households. You know, I empathize the fact that we as a society have to deal with this problem. But let me address, you know, this idea about black crime. You know, I think as one of your callers mentioned in the past hour, you know, there is a difference between black crime and black policing. And what I mean by that is that, you know, studies have shown that young black men are less likely to use or sell drugs than young white men, but are more likely to be arrested for drug use or sale. And once they are arrested, they're more likely to be sentenced. And once sentenced, they're more likely to receive long jail terms. You know, take, for example, the example of Ferguson, Missouri, which, as many know, was the location of controversy surrounding the shooting of Michael Brown. What the statistics revealed in Missouri was that, but despite the fact that blacks were disproportionately stopped at searched, the rate at which police found illegal drugs in these stop and frisks was higher among whites in Ferguson than blacks. And so if this is really a story about, you know, blacks and crime, then in order to reduce crime, we should actually be policing, you know, more whites. There should be a more equitable distribution of policing. You know, but I think what this is really about is that in any community that is economically marginalized, you're going to see higher levels of crime. You know, places where people have to resort to the underground community, there's going to be more instances of arrest and crime. You know, take, for example, rural communities in Appalachia, who have also seen the same types of deindustrialization and economic downturn that many of these same black communities face. You know, in these same all white communities, you're again seeing higher levels of crime. And, you know, there's a drug epidemic in terms of opioids and heroin. So this is, I would argue, is not a story about certain groups being more inherent to crime, but the fact that, you know, the history of our country in creating the segregated reality we live in today has created pockets of poverty that, you know, because of the economic marginalization, do see these higher levels of crime.
We are talking about white flight that is happening now. Sam Kai is a researcher who has studied and written about white flight in 2015, 2016. Sam joins us from Indiana. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We are also, you can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. Patty from Southern Wisconsin called. She wonders what levels of government created pockets of poverty. Was it state or local government or federal rules? This is, she's talking about redlining and post-World War II policies.
Yeah, so this happens at multiple levels, but certainly when it comes to this idea of redlining that happened in the post-World War II era, that was a federally mandated policy that created much of what we see today. But, you know, at the state level, you know, especially since the Fair Housing Act, of which we've just recently now seen the 50th anniversary, you know, one of the things that the Fair Housing Act intended to do was to outlaw explicit acts of discrimination, you know, against individuals. But, you know, one thing that has really plagued the Fair Housing Act is enforcement. We have known that, you know, even despite the fact that, you know, things like development funds and tax credits were supposed to be denied to places that had not taken affirmative steps to reducing segregation, that the enforcement of that policy is very weak. And in fact, you see in some locations that states and local communities that have actually had harmful policies that produce segregation, that they still receive these same types of development funds and tax credits. And so this occurs at multiple levels, but certainly to be clear, when we think about, you know, white flight as a result of redlining decades ago, that was certainly a federal policy that created those divisions.
Thank you very much, Patty, for calling in. The Fair Housing Act, during the Obama administration, did we start to enforce it more? Or is it just kind of been laying flat for a while?
You know, I think, to be clear, the Fair Housing Act was a very important piece of policy. You know, to think that as recently as 55, 60 years ago, that there could be explicit racial covenants that denied whole groups access to certain neighborhoods, to do away with those types of policies is an important milestone for our country. But the reality is that, you know, it's been tough to really measure whether or not we've made progress because of the fact that, you know, even despite this law, disparities in lending disparities in loans, they continue to persist, right? African Americans are still 60% more likely to be denied a loan than similarly situated whites. And likewise, we've seen other sorts of practices emerge that really hamper the Fair Housing Act. You know, I talked about the Great Recession earlier, and one of the reasons why it was so devastating is that, you know, blacks and Latinos have increasingly become the victims of predatory loans, these subprime loans that, you know, provide home ownership, but at a, you know, really insidious rate that, you know, when the housing bubble burst, drove many of these households back into poverty. So how far have we come? I would say, you know, we've certainly progressed, you know, when you examine residential segregation, to provide, you know, a silver lining to this rather sobering conversation. You know, residential segregation has declined, and it's important to know that over the past 30 years, residential segregation has declined between whites and blacks, over the past 30 years. But, you know, the reality is that in places like, for example, Milwaukee, Milwaukee is actually, along with Detroit, the most segregated metropolitan area in the U.S. today. In fact, in Milwaukee, over 70% of whites would have to change households in order to achieve integration.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. That's a staggering figure. And, you know, another thing to note is that, you know, as you mentioned in your lead up to this hour, there have been some who have said that white flight is no longer happening and we've approached the end of the segregated century. And a lot of people who state that cite these statistics about declining segregation over time. But the reality is that in locations where black populations are largest, declines in segregation have been relatively low. You know, if you were to take the entire black population of those metropolitan areas that have seen above average rates of integration, you get about 8 million blacks. But in contrast, those metropolitan areas that have seen slower than average rates of integration, it amounts to about 24 million blacks. Mm. So the takeaway there is that, yes, while individual metropolitan areas on average may be declining in segregation, those locations where blacks are most populous have seen very slow and stagnant rates of integration over time.
So you mentioned a moment ago penalties in lending that black and Latino populations end up paying more for their mortgage rates. And that the idea of reversing that is what some people blamed the recession on when it first started.
The idea that loans to black.
Right.
Yeah. What I would say is that the housing bubble was not created solely because of African Americans and Latino households. You know, there was something that was a long time coming because, again, of these predatory loans. I want to make sure that we're not steering into an area where we're blaming blacks and Latinos for, you know, taking these types of loans, right?
Right.
Again, home ownership is the primary vehicle of wealth creation in this country. In fact, if anything, what that era told us was that we really do need to monitor these realtors and banks that offer these types of predatory loans that truly take advantage of, you know, people who want to, you know, access the same type of American dream that, you know, many households have achieved for, you know, decades. You know, moving to suburban areas has been synonymous with good schools and low crimes. And that is, you know, a fabric of the American dream that should be available to all.
So that bust that myth. Black homeowners moving into white areas did not cause the recession.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, what caused the recession is you would need a whole panel of scholars and researchers aside from myself to truly get at that question. But, you know, I think the Great Recession was the cause of a variety of things. I can't say that I have the expertise to sit up here and definitively outline why that was the case, but certainly predatory loans were a component of what we saw in the 2000s.
Jeanette from Oshkosh, welcome to the program. What is your comment or question?
Hi. Here's my comment. I've lived in Oshkosh. I was born in southern Indiana. I have lived in Oshkosh for 21 years. And what I see going on in my neighborhood is that the only houses we have had problems with as far as crime is concerned are rentals. And what's going on in this city is there are slumlords, white male slumlords, who are renting to people, and they're renting to people who are on government assistance who are extremely impoverished, and the landlords refuse to maintain the integrity of the homes. They're falling apart. They don't care. And so if the landlord doesn't care, and a person who doesn't have a lot of money ends up moving into Oshkosh, but the housing they're in is falling apart, how can you expect them to take care of the property and mow the yards and clean up the trash and so forth when the landlords are not doing their part? And I think that's a big problem.
Jeanette, thank you for that. Sam, slumlords.
So again, this is a bit out of my domain, but you know, there's been a lot written about how landlords have, you know, taken advantage of many of the mobility programs and voucher systems that have been used in attempts to reduce segregation. You know, a lot of these landlords are largely uninterested, right, in providing affordable housing, but rather in taking advantage of these voucher systems. And in many cases, soon evicting residents to create kind of a churning process, right? Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that we know is that for people with vouchers, the waiting list to move into good neighborhoods is months and months, months on end. And so for these slumlords, as Jeanette called them, you know, they have very little incentive to maintain upkeep, right, and to, you know, maintain properties because, again, the system that we live in today has created a reality where, you know, there's such a large demand for access to certain neighborhoods that, again, the incentive system doesn't create a healthy environment for upkeep and maintenance.
We are talking about white flight in 2018 with researcher Sam Kai. We're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. We're going to look at Kai's research methods in a moment. It's The Morning Show. It's a morning show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Sam Kai is a PhD student at Indiana University Bloomington. He studies migration patterns and has written about white flight in our current culture. We're taking your calls and emails, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Sam Kent from Reedstown called. He wants to know about the role of sundown towns in this conversation, those all-white communities that specifically said, you can't be here after dark if you are Black.
Yeah, so certainly sundown towns are an example of these types of communities that utilize these racial covenants, but especially in sundown towns, threats of violence to ensure that, you know, Black households would not move in. And so, you know, at the surface, you know, the legacy of those sundown towns is that during that era, they preserved racial segregation. But in the contemporary, I think, you know, one thing you see is that because of sundown towns and things of that nature, you know, many Black households today still express some hesitance moving into predominantly white neighborhoods. You know, what you find is that Black families do not want to be the pioneers into a Black neighborhood because whether it's substantiated or not, they're, you know, still unsure how they're going to be treated, how their kids might be treated. And, you know, I think what you would find is that many of these predominantly white neighborhoods would, in fact, you know, welcome some levels of diversity into their communities. But again, because of things like sundown towns, you have these counter stereotypes of white neighborhoods that maybe are not as welcoming. So again,
so it seems to me like a white neighborhood that wanted to be integrated, that wanted to be forward looking, would then have to do some sort of marketing thing to invite people in.
Yes. And some of the best example of successful integration efforts are these locations where that type of marketing has been done. So one example is in the Oak Park neighborhood in Chicago. That regional housing center provides one-on-one counseling for people who want to move into the community to explicitly do away with these types of heuristics and mental shortcuts that people take of certain locations in the neighborhood. You know, what they found in Oak Park was that, you know, Black families came in with this certain idea of white neighborhoods. And by contrast, white families would come in with this certain idea of Black neighborhoods. And what that regional housing center does is they actually takes them on tours of neighborhoods. And what people actually find is that, oh, this is a Black neighborhood, but it looks great. Or, oh, this is a white neighborhood and, you know, they would be more than welcoming. And those types of efforts are successful. You know, for this one example in Oak Park, you know, over the several past years, 70% of incoming movers move into neighborhoods where their own group is not the predominant group.
And in Oak Park.
Yes, in Oak Park. And so these types of efforts, I think, are still relatively rare, but especially because they help tremendously in reducing these types of stereotypes, there has been a large call for more of these types of programs moving forward.
A lot of the numbers that you're looking at are publicly available. You took census numbers, correct?
Correct.
And how did you, what gave you the idea to do that? How did you model these numbers?
Yeah, so, you know, there are two types of, there are two streams of white flight research, if you will. One type of research is at what we call the individual level. So it actually examines white households and sees precisely, okay, when they move, where are they moving? How does that correlate with the racial composition of a neighborhood? And the advantage of studies like that is that you can actually, you know, speak to white households, see, you know, the types of reasons they use for moving. But the reason why I wanted to use census data is because it provides a broader ability to see nationwide what are the large scale trends that we're seeing. So you can simplify it crudely in terms of what are we seeing versus why are we seeing it. And again, the reason why I wanted to use census data was because of these trends of suburbanization that we have been seeing. And so what I do is I take data, as you mentioned, that is publicly available, and I define neighborhoods as middle class and poor according to several traits that we know tend to cluster in communities. So some specific characteristics that I made sure to account for were the percentage of high school dropouts, median household income, home values. But it was also important for my research to the best available ability to account for other factors that might explain white flight, right? So, you know, things like residential turnover, the percentage of structures that are old. And basically, after doing all that, I used statistical analyses to identify the independent effect of, you know, living in a neighborhood with large presence of Black, Hispanic, and Asian residents, and how that was associated with white flight.
And when more Black, Hispanic residents move in and Asian residents move in, is there a point at which white people say, I'm out of here?
Yeah, so this is all, this goes back to the idea of tipping points, right? Is there a critical tipping point where whites say they've had enough? And, you know, I think what my research can do is say, on average, when you take into consideration all these factors, what does that number look like? And yes, my research does identify that number at around 20%. But again, you know, this is very contextually dependent, and it's going to vary across metropolitan areas and communities.
Crystal from Union Grove actually has a question that that pertains to this. Crystal, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I'm so enjoying the show. My question was, because a previous caller had said when white people move into neighborhoods, it's called gentrification, and when they move out, it's called white flight. But I was hoping the speaker could talk about the difference in the motivations for those types of moves, because I think the previous caller felt demonized for both, and so felt like he could not win. If you could speak to that.
Yes. So let me restate it, because it was kind of a wonky line here. She wants to know the motivations between white people who move out of areas that people of color are moving into, and the motivations of white people who are moving into areas of people where people of color are. And she talked about gentrification, but I think there's two different things here. There are people moving into areas and pushing people of color out, and then there are people who are moving into areas to live in an integrated area. So what are the differences between those people?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think gentrification, as we understand it, is, again, this idea of moving into urban neighborhoods. And as you mentioned, there have been several studies that have identified the consequences of gentrification. And it's important to note that, you know, well, in the public discourse, when we think about gentrification, we think about whites moving into Black neighborhoods. But, you know, actually what the research shows is that when among urban neighborhoods that are really heavily segregated, it's not the Black neighborhoods that are being gentrified, but actually it's those locations that have a foothold of Hispanic and Asian residents, which are more likely to see gentrification occur. And this often occurs without inclusionary zoning that would otherwise enable, right, Black middle-class households perhaps to move in, or, you know, other households to take advantage of the advantages that gentrification brings. So this idea that, you know, gentrification is integrating our communities, that is true to an extent. And I say to an extent because you really aren't seeing the gentrification of predominantly Black neighborhoods. Mm. But, you know, as you mentioned, there are different types of gentrification. One is to live in more, you know, I think, too, it's important to stress that people aren't just moving in to live in integrated neighborhoods. I mean, that could certainly be part of the rationale. But also what we know about our urban neighborhoods is that they're more walkable. They're more dense in terms of restaurants and things of that nature. I mean, you had several callers who talked about the lake in Milwaukee and the river storefronts and things of that sort. So there are many amenities within urban neighborhoods that bring back, you know, whites into urban spaces. And integration is certainly one. But again, I think it's important to note that, you know, I think the reason why gentrification has received attention in terms of its negative aspects is because of the fact that, you know, it's mimicking a trajectory that we've seen in this country for quite some time. And what I mean by that is that, you know, during the 1960s, when you had this subset of white residents, a massive subset of whites who moved out into suburban neighborhoods. But what you also had were elite whites who remained in urban neighborhoods that were affiliated to hospitals or universities, who also barricaded themselves against the Black ghetto by pushing the government to enact these quote-unquote development policies that completely uprooted existing Black neighborhoods and concentrated them into the notorious forms of public housing that have since been dismantled. So I think that is, again, some of the hesitance that we see with gentrification, because it is eerily similar to the same types of development policies that, again, had a devastating effect in concentrating poverty among Blacks.
We have been talking to Samuel Kai. He researches race and community. He's a PhD student at Indiana University Bloomington. His latest research focuses on ethnic trends in urban neighborhoods, and he has written about white flight. Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Bultina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman. This is the Ideas Network, and thank you for listening.